A field of beautiful flowers? Clearly you must have been hallucinating.
Clearly.
Magnus pulled it to him, gentler now, as if afraid she might break.
We will live through this, my princess. All of this. And then, yes, I will marry you properly.
Promise? She asked, a tremor in her voice.
I promise, he replied firmly. And until then, I have faith in my sister that she will end Kyan and find a solution to this hateful magic inside of you.
Magnus and Cleo returned to the palace slightly disheveled, but determined to find a solution to the long list of problems that plagued them. After Magnus had heard the 20th, "I thought you were dead," comment, he chose to retire to his chambers with his beautiful wife. And there they discussed every moment that had passed for each of them since they last saw each other. Cleo slid her fingers over the golden ring on Magnus's left hand.
"I hate your father. I always will," she said, just before she fell asleep in his arms. "But I would be eternally grateful to him for this."
Yes. The Bloodstone definitely complicated his already complicated feelings for the man who had made his life far more painful than it should have been. Perhaps tomorrow, the king's speech would mark the beginning of a new chapter in their lives as father and son. Magnus knew he himself had changed so much over the last year. Change could happen, if one wanted it to. Perhaps there was room for hope. The next morning, they lingered far too long in their sleeping chambers, taking breakfast there instead of joining King Gaius and Lucia and Lyssa. Magnus still could not believe his sister had an infant daughter, but he knew he could accept it. He already loved Lyssa, and knew he would do anything to protect his newborn niece. As Magnus lay in bed, he propped himself up on his elbow to watch as Cleo pulled on her slip and fiddled with the laces, expecting at any moment for her to ask him for assistance. But then she froze in place. Her eyes locked on the wall in front of her, and her mouth twisted in pain. Magnus jumped up and grasped hold of her shoulders.
"What's happening?" he demanded.
"Drowning," she managed. I feel like I'm drowning."
His gaze shot to her right hand, to the vine of blue line spreading from the water magic symbol. Before his very eyes, the lines traveled up higher along her skin, encircling her upper arm.
"No," he said, panic clawing at his chest. "You're not drowning. You're here with me, and everything is fine. Don't let this overwhelm you."
I'm trying.
"And you, water kindred."
He stared fiercely into her blue-green eyes.
"If you can hear me, you need to release your hold on Cleo, if that's what this is. I will destroy you. I will destroy all of you, I swear it."
Cleo collapsed in his arms, gasping for breath like she'd just come up from the depths of the ocean.
"It's past," she managed a moment later. "I'm fine."
"You're not fine. This is not fine," he snarled back at her, the pain of being unable to save her from this nearly unbearable. "This is as far from fine as anything that has ever been."
She righted herself, pushing away from him, and quickly donning the dark blue gown she'd chosen to wear today.
"We have to go. Your father's speech. He needs you there."
"I'll get Nerissa to attend to you. You don't have to be on the balcony with us. I want to be there."
She met his gaze, and he could see the strength in her eyes, along with the frustration.
"By your side, so everyone can see us together."
"But I insist, Magnus. Please."
He nodded, grudgingly in agreement, and placed a hand on her back, guiding her out of the room to join his father and Lucia in the throne room.
"So nice of you to join us," the king said thinly.
"We were otherwise occupied," Magnus replied.
"Yes, I'm sure you were."
His attention moved to Cleo.
"You look well."
Cleo met his gaze directly.
I am well.
Good.
I wish you the greatest luck with your speech, she said, a steady smile on her face. I know how much the Oranian people love a good speech from their beloved king. Your recent decisions with Amara will be all but forgotten, I'm sure.
Magnus shared an amused look with Lucia, one that reminded him so much of those they'd shared over the years whenever they witnessed the king say something unkind to a guest. But he always managed to say it in a way that almost sounded like a compliment. Almost.
Indeed, the king replied. It seemed the king and Cleo had far more in common than Magnus ever would have thought.
From the throne room, accompanied by guards, the four took a winding staircase, located behind the dais, to the third floor and the large balcony overlooking the palace square. The last time Magnus and Cleo had been present for a speech by the king on this very balcony, they had been betrothed, much to their mutual surprise and abject horror. Lucia's beautiful face held pain, her blue eyes as serious as Magnus had ever seen them.
"Is there something wrong?"
Magnus asked his sister, as they stepped onto the balcony to the cheers of the thousands gathered below.
"What isn't wrong?" she replied quietly. "Shall I give you a list with Cain at the very top of it?"
"Not necessary."
"Silence, both of you," the king said under his breath,
before he grasped hold of the marble railing and turned to the Oranians, who milled below in the palace square, gazing up at the king with both interest and skepticism on their faces. Then Gaius began to speak in a strong and powerful voice that traveled easily across the distance.
"In the Maros, our credo is strength, faith, and wisdom," the king began. "Three values that we believe can see us through any adversity. But today I want to talk about truth. I've come to believe it is the most valuable treasure in the world."
Magnus watched his father, unsure just what to expect from this speech. It would be unusual for the king to speak truthfully in such public appearances. Normally, he projected the illusion of a king who cared more for his people than he did for power. Not everyone knew the real reasons behind his nickname of the King of Blood. The spell that had been cast upon Gaius de Mora by his mother 17 years ago had helped him to focus on his drive for power and the ruthlessness and deception that were necessary to keep his crown and eventually deceive Chief Basilius and crush King Corvin in a single day. That was the only father Magnus had ever known.
"Today I also ask you all to look toward the future," the king continued. "For I believe it will be brighter than the past. I believe this because of the young people who stand with me today on this very balcony. They are the future, just as your sons and daughters are. They are our truth."
The king glanced at Magnus.
A bright future, Magnus thought. Does he really mean this?
King Gaius turned toward the crowd again.
"Perhaps you feel that you cannot trust me. Perhaps you hate me and all I have stood for in the past. I don't blame you, not one of you, for feeling that way. I had reached an unavoidable crossroads when I chose to align with Cratia, leading to the occupation of Mitica these last months. Had I not made this difficult decision, there would have been war, death, and in the end, tremendous loss."
Magnus agreed to a point. Still, he believed his father had been unforgivably hasty in his decision to align with the Emperor of Cratia and his duplicitous daughter. Then again, there was a time not so long ago when his father suggested that Magnus marry Amara to help forge an alliance between Mitica and the Empire. To his recollection, Magnus had laughed in the king's face at the thought of it.
"What I would regret is if I allowed it to continue a day longer than necessary," the king said.
Some have come to believe that Amara Cortis represents the future of Mitica. And they are wrong. She has chosen to leave Mitica and return to her home where she can be safe from the fallout from her greedy choices. More than half of her army has departed with her, with no announcement, no promises for the future. Amara Cortis's truth is that she doesn't care at all about the future of Mitica or its people. But I do. There were murmurings of disbelief coming from the crowd now. Magnus glanced at Cleo, who had kept a pleasant, attentive smile on her lips since the speech began, as if she believed and endorsed every single word spoken by the king. An enviable talent, indeed.
"Ithaca is not only my kingdom," King Gaia said. "It is my home. It is my responsibility. And I have failed to live up to my promises, to my position as your leader from the moment I first took the throne of Lemurus. My choices for more than 2 decades have been fueled by my own greed and desire for power. But today begins a new era in this kingdom. One of truth."
Cleo reached for Magnus's hand and squeezed it. He realized he'd been holding his breath. His father's words were so unexpected and edged with an honesty he'd never witnessed before. King Gaius continued.
"My daughter Lucia stands with me today. There are rumors that she is a witch, one of the few I have allowed to live during my reign. Some say that makes me a hypocrite, since she is dangerous, far more dangerous than any common witch in recorded history."
Magnus tried to catch Lucia's gaze, but his sister's expression was blank, her attention fixed on something in the distance beyond the golden walls of the city. She did not share Cleo's talent for being present and poised in such a situation. Lucia had never enjoyed being under close scrutiny. She and Magnus might not share blood, but they shared that much.
"My daughter possesses great magic. And yes, she is most certainly dangerous. Dangerous to those who wish to do harm to us."
So it would seem that Lucia's secret was no longer a secret. Magnus wondered how she felt about this revelation.
"Some won't believe me. Some will think me a bitter man whose new wife has turned her back on him and returned to her homeland. They again are wrong."
The king produced a parchment from beneath his surcoat, holding it up so all could see it.
"This is my agreement with Emperor Cortis before his death, to make Mitica a part of the Cretian Empire. It is signed in blood, my blood, signed before I married Amara as a part of this deal."
The king tore up the contract and let the pieces of parchment fall off the balcony. A collective gasp came from the crowd. Magnus wasn't sure how much weight this gesture held. It was, after all, a simple piece of paper. But the crowd seemed to gobble it up, every word, every gesture.
"Today I shall begin to make right what has gone so terribly wrong during my reign," the king promised. "The Empress is not welcome in my kingdom, nor is her army. From this day forward, we will stand together, united against—"
Then the king fell silent. From the far corner of the balcony, Magnus waited for him to continue, certain that all of this was a dream. A speech filled with unity and hope and grit, and quite a lot of anti-Amara sentiment, of which Magnus certainly approved. But then Cleo's grip on Magnus's hand suddenly became painfully tight. A single cry sounded out from the crowd, and then another. Soon, many were screaming, wailing, shouting, and pointing up at the balcony.
"Father!"
Lucia gasped. Magnus dropped Cleo's hand and raced to his father's side. An arrow protruded from the king's chest. He looked down at it and frowned. Then, with all his strength, he gripped it and yanked it out with a loud, pained grunt. But then another arrow hit him, and then another, and another. Chapter 16. Lucia, Uranus. 4 arrows, each precisely finding its mark in her father's heart. King Gaius collapsed to his knees and fell to his side with a heavy thud. The life faded from his dark brown eyes. Lucia found herself frozen with shock, unable to think or move. Magnus frantically pulled the arrows out of the king's flesh and pressed his hands over the wounds, but it did nothing to help stanch the flow of crimson blood.
"No, you are not going to die, not today."
Magnus's hands were slick with his father's blood as he slid the bloodstone ring onto the king's finger. Magnus then took several gulping breaths before he cast a pained look at Lucia.
"It's not working. Do something," he shouted at her. "Heal him!"
Lucia staggered to the king's side and fell to her knees. She could sense the dark magic from the ring, the same magic that had saved both her father's and brother's lives before. The coldness of this magic repelled her. She had to force herself to get closer to it.
"What are you waiting for?"
Magnus roared. Lucia squeezed her eyes shut and tried to will earth magic into her hands. The healing magic that had saved Magnus during the battle to take Uranus when he was moments from death. Since then, she'd mended his broken leg in countless cuts and scrapes. Such magic had become second nature to her. She sensed a trace of this valuable magic within her, but far less than a prophesied sorceress should possess, and far less than she'd need to heal an injury as profound as this. Lucia already knew the horrible truth. Even if she had all the magic in the universe, it wouldn't help. Her gaze flipped to Cleo, who'd covered her mouth with her hand at the bloody sight before her, eyes wide and filled with horror. The princess came forward and put her shaky hand on Magnus's shoulder, the thin, winding blue lines visible past the lacy sleeve of her violet gown. Magnus didn't push her away. His attention was far too fixed on Lucia.
"Well?"
he demanded. Hot tears streaked down Lucia's cheeks.
I'm sorry." "What do you mean, you're sorry?"
Magnus stared down at his father's face, at his glazed, unblinking eyes.
"Fix him!"
His voice broke.
"Please." "I can't,"
she whispered. The king was dead. Lucia struggled to her feet. Tears streamed down her face as she ran from the balcony to her chambers.
"Get out!"
she screamed at the nursemaid. The nursemaid rushed out the door. Lucia moved to the cradle and looked down upon Lyssa's face, not with the love of a mother, but with blind fury. Her eyes glowed with violet light.
"You've stolen my magic, haven't you?"
she hissed. If her elementia had been close to the surface, easily accessible at the merest of thoughts, Lucia might have reacted quicker after the first arrow hit. But her senses had become dulled, useless, and now her father was dead because of it.
"You've destroyed everything,"
she snarled at the child. Lyssa's eyes shifted back to blue, and she looked up at her mother for a moment before she began to cry. The sound pierced Lucia's heart, and guilt washed over her.
"I am evil,"
she whispered as she sank to the floor, pulling her legs up to hug them against her body.
"It's my fault. All my fault. It should have been me who died today, not father."
She stayed in that position for what felt like a very long time, while Lyssa cried only an arm's reach away. After a while, Magnus came to her door. Lucia's eyes were dry, and her heart was empty of all emotion as she looked up at her brother.
"The assassin was captured before he managed to escape," Magnus said. "I've asked to personally interrogate him."
She waited, not speaking.
"I would appreciate your help, if you're willing," he said.
Yes. Lucia most definitely would be willing to interrogate their father's murderer. She pushed herself up to her feet and accompanied Magnus out of her chambers. The nursemaid waited patiently outside, glancing nervously at Lucia.
"My apologies for my harshness," Lucia said to her.
The nursemaid bowed her head.
"Not at all, Your Grace. My deepest condolences to you for your loss."
Silently, her heart a lead weight deep within her chest, Lucia followed Magnus through the halls of the palace, barely seeing anything to her left or right, only putting one foot in front of the other as they made their way out of the building and down to the dungeon. The prisoner was a young man, in his early 20s. He had been placed in a small room, his wrists and ankles bound in iron chains and shackled to the stone wall.
"What is your name?"
Magnus asked, his voice cold. He wore the bloodstone ring again, his hands now clean of the king's blood. The man didn't reply. Lucia had had so much to say to her father that would forever remain unsaid. This assassin had stolen that from her. Lucia turned a look of sheer hatred upon him.
"You will die for what you did today," she spat.
The man glanced up at her, only long enough to sneer.
"You're the witch daughter he spoke of," he said. "Are you going to use your magic on me?"
"You don't sound afraid."
"I'm not afraid of any common witch. Oh, I'm much more than that."
Lucia moved close enough to grab the man by his throat, digging her fingernails into his flesh and forcing him to meet her gaze.
"Who are you? A rebel or an assassin?"
She tried to pull the truth from his mouth like she'd done with Lord Gareth, but he simply eyed her with defiance.
"I did what I did for Cratia," he hissed. "For the Empress. Do your worst to me. I have fulfilled my destiny."
"For the Empress,"
Magnus repeated, his dark eyes narrowed.
"Did Amara command you to kill the king? Or did you make that decision all on your own?"
"And what if she did? You have no chance for revenge. She is far above all of you in this minuscule kingdom."
The killer narrowed his gaze at the prince.
"Your father was a coward and a liar, a mere worm in the presence of magnificence. And he squandered his chance at true greatness by acting and speaking against the Empress. I was commanded to kill him publicly so that everyone would know he's dead."
"Is that so?"
Magnus said, the words so quiet Lucia could barely hear them. His fist shook with the overwhelming need to reduce this man to ash. Her brother drew closer to the man.
"I found that I must pay you a compliment and that your marksmanship is second to none. I've never seen anyone as skilled with a crossbow before. The guards tell me you were at the back of the crowd when you took aim at the king. 4 arrows, not missing your target once. Amara must value you very much."
The killer snorted.
"Such a compliment is meaningless from anyone but the Empress."
The blade of the dagger glinted in the torchlight just before Magnus thrust it upward into the man's chin and straight into his brain. Breath tight in her chest, Lucia watched as the man twitched, then slumped over, perfectly still. Magnus glanced at Lucia.
"What is wrong with your Elementia?"
he asked, his tone cold and controlled. Her first instinct was to lie, but the time for lies was past.
"It failed me,"
Lucia admitted, the words like broken glass in her throat.
"Lyssa, I don't understand it, but she's been stealing my magic since even before she was born."
Magnus nodded slowly. He wiped the sharp edge of his blade with a handkerchief, the red blood appearing black in the shadows of the dungeon cell.
"So you can't help Cleo,"
he said.
"And you can do nothing to defeat Cayan."
A flash of anger ignited within her at this dismissal.
"I didn't say that."
"That's what I heard.
I'm trying to find a solution," she said. "I won't let you down again.
Her brother's expression was unreadable to her, void of emotion. She couldn't tell if he was upset or angry or disappointed. Likely all three.
"I certainly hope not," he finally replied.
Magnus didn't say another word as she left the dungeon and slowly made her way back to the palace. The first thing she noticed when she entered her chambers was the scent of burning flesh. Her gaze fell with horror upon the blackened, smoldering corpse of the nursemaid in the center of the room. A cry escaped Lucia's throat, a pained screech that barely sounded human. She ran to the cradle to find it empty. Lyssa was gone. Chapter 17. Jonas. Aranus. Jonas didn't attend the king's speech. He already knew far too well what to expect. False promises, lies, more lies. Typical political horse dung. Instead, he and Felix scoured the city of gold looking for Asher. Since his arrival yesterday in the palace city with the very much not-dead Prince Magnus, the Croatian prince had been visiting local taverns where, he said, the tongues of patrons were loose and ready to reveal secrets their sober selves might not provide. Secrets about magic. Secrets about local witches. Secrets about someone, anyone, who might be able to lend their skills to help end Cayan the moment he showed his stolen face. Jonas had his own secret means of ending Cayan, safe in the sheath on his belt. From what frustratingly little Timotheus had shared with him about the golden dagger, he thought that it would end the fire god very nicely. However, it would also end Nick as well, and so they searched for other possibilities. Jonas walked with Felix down the busy street lined with shops and bakeries and places where Iranians could buy shiny baubles to wear clipped to their ears and strung around their necks. Many people were walking in the direction of the palace, ready to stand in the palace square shoulder to shoulder in the blazing heat of midday to listen to King Gaius's most recent set of lies. A man in a dark blue surcoat embroidered with what looked like sparkling diamonds bumped into Felix. He glared at him and pushed his way past.
"Do you ever want to start killing people at random just because they're a bunch of rich, pompous asses?"
Felix muttered to Jonas, watching the man walk away.
"I used to,"
Jonas admitted.
"I hated royals. Hated Oranians just for having the privileges denied to us in Pelsea. And now?"
"The urge is there, but I know it would be wrong."
Felix groaned.
"Perhaps. But it would feel so good. Right? Let out some pent-up frustration."
He nodded at a pair of green-uniformed Croatian soldiers watching over the flow of citizens up ahead.
"We could start with them."
The sight of Amara's dwindling but continuing occupation was a reminder of more oppression.
"Frankly, I wouldn't stop you."
"Did you see Enzo in his guard's uniform this morning?"
Felix scrunched his nose as if he smelled something foul.
"He finally went back to work at his post. Said it was his honor to do so."
"He's Lemurian down to his red blood. He can't help but be bound to duty and honor, even if it means taking orders from King Gaius himself."
Jonas gave his friend a wry look.
"Sometimes I forget that you're Lemurian, too. You don't exactly fit in with the rest of them, do you?"
Felix smirked.
"Part of my charm is that I fit in wherever I am. I'm a chameleon."
There was no part of Felix Gabrus, eye patch and glowering, intimidating presence combined, that fit in wherever he was. But Jonas chose not to argue with him.
"You are indeed a chameleon," he said instead, nodding. "Perhaps that's why Enzo's been in such a bad mood the last couple of days,"
Felix said as they paused in front of a shop with impressively clear windows that showed a selection of decorated cakes and pastries.
"Insufferable, really."
Jonas already knew far too much about Enzo's moods.
"He proposed marriage to Nerissa." "What?"
Felix regarded him with shock.
"And what did Nerissa say to that?"
"She said no."
Felix nodded, his expression turning thoughtful.
Clearly, that's because she's fallen madly in love with me.
She hasn't.
Give her time.
You believe what you want to believe.
I will.
Jonas glanced over his shoulder in the direction of the palace, which lay in the direct center of the city. He could see its highest golden tower above the shops surrounding them.
I wonder how long the king is going to talk.
Hours, likely. He enjoys the sound of his voice far more than anyone else does.
Felix cast a look at the maze of storefronts and buildings around them.
We're never going to find Asher if he doesn't want to be found. Remember when we were in Basilia, and poof, he'd just be gone? Just wandered off and didn't even tell anyone. Kreshins are so sneaky.
Asher's just doing what he needs to do.
So, him and Nick, huh?
Felix said, raising a brow above his eye patch.
I knew there was something there, but it didn't completely click until we were in the pit, and then I'm all, I knew it, because I did know it. You can just tell these things.
Jonas frowned at him.
What are you talking about?
Asher and... Nick.
Felix spread his hands.
There.
The sound of a scream caught their attention. It was followed by more shouts and a commotion coming from the palace area. Felix gave Jonas a grim look.
Must have been some speech.
We need to get back, Jonas said. They hurried back to the palace without another word. Jonas's heart pounded fast and hard as he caught a man's shoulder going past him.
What's going on?
He asked.
The king,
the man said, his face pale and his eyes round.
The king is dead!
Jonas stared after him as the man scurried away. Once they reached the palace, they found it in chaos. Every guard they passed had his sword drawn, ready for battle.
It can't be true, Jonas said as the pair rushed through the corridors. I don't believe it!
They found Nerissa walking swiftly down the hallway that led to their bedchambers.
Nerissa!
Jonas called out to her.
What's going on?
The commotion in the city. Some say King Gaius is dead.
He is,
she confirmed, her voice small.
It happened during his speech. An archer in the audience. He was captured before he could escape.
It still seemed far too surreal for Jonas to accept.
You saw it?
She nodded.
I saw everything. It was horrible. Lucia and Magnus and Cleo were with him on the balcony.
Is Lucia... he began.
Is Cleo...
they're fine.
Or as fine as can be expected given the circumstances. I can only assume the king's death was instant, or else Princess Lucia should have been able to heal him with her magic.
A rebel, Jonas said, shaking his head.
Some rebel finally took the king out.
Yes. Nerissa's expression didn't hold any grief, but her eyes were filled with worry.
I assume the assassin will be publicly executed after he's questioned.
Felix crossed his thick arms over his broad chest.
Is it wrong that I'm slightly envious that I wasn't the one to do it?
Nerissa glared at him.
Seriously, Felix?
He left me behind in Kreshia to take the blame for the Emperor's murder.
Not exactly something I can forgive and forget.
I'm glad he's dead.
I would strongly advise you to keep that opinion to yourself, Nerissa said. Especially around Prince Magnus and Princess Lucia.
Jonas barely registered their conversation. He was deep in thought, remembering the time when he'd shoved a dagger into the king's heart, certain that he'd finally done what no one else had been able to do. But it was an injury the king survived because of some spell cast upon him by his witch mother.
I can't believe he's dead, Jonas said, shaking his head. The King of Blood is finally dead.
Jonas had to agree with Felix. This assassination had brought with it more good than bad. Perhaps the rebel had been working with Terrace Vasco. Perhaps it had been Terrace himself. He was about to ask Nerissa more about the archer, but his attention moved to someone who'd appeared at the end of the hallway. Princess Lucia swiftly moved toward them. Despite his hatred for the king, Lucia was his daughter, and she'd witnessed his death. Certainly, She mourned him and was in pain. Jonas swore he would not make that pain worse than it already was.
"Princess," he said softly. "I heard what happened."
Her sky-blue eyes met his, her brows drawn together.
"I told her this was all her fault. And she cried so hard. Harder than I've ever heard her cry before. It's my fault this happened. Perhaps I should have said yes right away and he wouldn't have done this. I'm such a fool. Such a stupid, stupid fool."
"Lucia," Jonas frowned. "What are you talking about?" Then his gaze fell with horror on the dagger in her grip. Her other hand dripped blood on the marble floor. "What did you do?" he demanded. "Did you cut yourself?" Lucia looked down at the injury, a deep slice over the palm of her right hand.
"I'd heal it, but I can't." "Princess, why did you do this to yourself?"
Nerissa asked, as she pulled a handkerchief from her pocket and quickly wrapped it around the princess's hand. Lucia looked blankly down at the bandage.
"That night, so long ago, I summoned him with the symbol for fire magic drawn on the snowy ground in my own blood. Alexius told me how to do it before he died, but nothing happened this time. I don't know how to find him and get her back."
"Who are you talking about?" Felix's voice was much harsher than either Jonas's or Nerissa's when addressing the princess. "You're not saying you tried to summon Kai in here, are you?" Lucia's gaze moved to Felix's single eye.
"It took Lyssa."
"What?" Jonas gasped.
"No, that's impossible. The nursemaid is in ashes. It happened when I was with Magnus and my father's assassin in the dungeon. When I came back to my chambers, Lyssa was gone."
Her breath hitched sharply, and she let out a sob.
"I need to go."
She tried to move past them, but Jonas grabbed hold of her wrist to stop her.
"Where are you going?" he demanded.
"I need to find Timotheus. I need his answers and I need his help."
Her expression hardened into one of cold steel.
"And if he refuses, I swear on Valoria's heart that I will kill him. Now let go of me."
"No," he said. "You're not making any damn sense. I know your father just died and that was a true horror for you to witness. Perhaps you're imagining things. What you need is rest. What I need,"
her tone turned to jagged ice,
"is for you to let go of me."
She wrenched her arm away, and Jonas was suddenly airborne, tossed halfway down the hall. When he hit the hard marble floor, it knocked the breath from his lungs.
"Lucia, stop!"
She didn't stop. He saw only the swish of her dark gray skirt as she turned a corner up ahead and disappeared from view. Felix's hand appeared before his face. He took it and let his friend help him back up to his feet.
"Who in the hell is Timotheus?"
Felix asked. Only an immortal who'd seen a future that included the same golden dagger Jonas now possessed embedded in Lucia's chest. Before he could answer Felix's question aloud, someone else headed down the hallway toward their trio.
"I need to speak with you, Agalon," Magnus growled.
The Demora siblings were equally forthright and equally unbearable.
"About Lucia?" he asked.
"No."
Jonas itched to follow the princess, to try to stop her from whatever carnage she was bound to cause in her grief and confusion. But the best course of action was to sit down and calmly formulate a plan. He had changed a lot since his days as a rebel leader, and he wasn't sure if such hesitation was an asset or a liability.
"Then what is it?"
Jonas asked impatiently.
"I need you to go to Cretia."
His gaze shot to the prince.
"Why?"
"Because Amara Cortis needs to die."
"What?"
Magnus absently stroked his scarred right cheek.
"She is responsible for my father's murder. I won't allow her to get away with it without penalty. She is a threat to everything and everyone."
Jonas forced himself to take a breath. Both Lucia and Magnus were in mourning, causing them to act irrationally and recklessly.
"Your vengeance is understandable," Jonas said, keeping his voice steady. "But that's an impossible request. Even if I agreed, I couldn't get close to her without discovery, let alone manage to escape after an assassination attempt." He shook his head. "It's impossible."
"I'll go," Felix said simply. Jonas shot him a look of surprise.
"Bad idea, Felix."
"Disagree," he replied. "It's a great idea."
"Your Highness," Nerissa said, "with utmost respect, I must ask, is this the right move at this time? I thought your position was that our focus needed to remain on the Kindred and on helping Cleo and Taryn."
Magnus turned a dark look on the girl. "That is still my focus. But this is also the right move, one that should have been taken months ago. Amara is responsible for countless atrocities committed against innocents."
"So is your father," Nerissa said, not flinching when Magnus's glare intensified. "Apologies, but it's the truth."
"I leave immediately," Felix said. "Happy to serve. I've been waiting for this chance."
"Chance to do what?" Jonas said, glaring at his friend.
"Get yourself killed. It's a chance I'm willing to take."
Felix shrugged and spread his hands.
"This is what I do, and I'm damn good at it, Your Highness.
Jonas has perhaps a few too many pesky morals in place when it comes to the thought of killing a woman, but me? Right woman, right time, right blade, or hell, my bare hands, and she won't be anyone's problem anymore."
"Good," Magnus said with a sharp nod. "Leave today and take whomever you need as backup."
"I'll need no one but myself."
"I'll go with you," Nerissa said.
Felix rolled his eyes.
"What? To try to stop me? To remind me that everyone deserves a shiny chance at redemption?"
"Save your breath."
"No. I'll go to make sure you don't get yourself unnecessarily slaughtered. I came to know Amara very well during my short time in her service, and I believe she trusts me, despite my choice to side with Princess Cleo."
Felix eyed her with doubt.
"You won't try to stop me?"
"No. I'll help you."
"Good," Magnus said. "You will go with Felix, and kindly let Amara know before she draws her last breath that this was on my orders."
Felix bowed his head. "It will be my pleasure, Your Highness."
Magnus turned as if to leave, but Jonas knew he couldn't let him.
"Lucia is gone," he said.
Magnus's shoulders tensed. He turned around slowly and glared at Jonas, a look so menacing that Jonas nearly winced from it.
"What?" he snapped.
"She believes Kayan was here just now, that he kidnapped Lyssa. She's gone after him."
Magnus swore under his breath.
"Is it true? Was Kayan here and no alarms were raised?"
"I don't know for sure, but Lucia most definitely seemed to think so."
"I can't leave. Not with Cleo here, not with everything that's happened today."
A thread of panic had entered Magnus's deep voice. Then he swore again before he looked at Jonas.
"You."
Jonas frowned.
"Me? Go after my sister. Bring her back. You're certainly not my first choice, but you did it once, and you can damn well do it again. This is a command."
Jonas glared at him.
"A command, is it?"
The fierceness in Magnus's dark eyes fell away, replaced by worry.
"Fine. I won't command you. I'll ask you. Please. I trust you to do this more than anyone else. Please, find my sister and bring her back. If she's right, if this was Kyan's doing, together we will search for my niece."
Jonas couldn't speak. He nodded once. He would do as Magnus asked him. But he wouldn't drag Lucia back here kicking and screaming. He didn't think he could even if he wanted to. Instead, he would follow her, and he would help her.
"And," he thought with pained determination, "if Timotheus is right,
and she ends up using her magic to help Kayan, dooming the rest of the world and everyone in it. He slid his hand over the golden dagger at his hip. Then I will kill her. Chapter 18. Amara. Cratia. Amara knew that because of her, a monster was free. One that would destroy the world unless it was stopped. And she'd left the mess behind her for others to clean up. She'd hoped that the farther she sailed from the shores of Mitica, the freer she'd feel. But the invisible chains tying her to what she'd done did not break, even as the jewel of the Empire finally loomed into view before her. Her beautiful home would also be destroyed if Kayan wasn't imprisoned again. She would have to have faith in Lucia, and in Cleo. For now, that faith would have to be enough. Costas, the only member of her guard Amara knew she could trust, remained in Mitica to keep a close watch over the royals. She'd commanded him to send a message of any news, no matter how small or insignificant it seemed. A celebration awaited her as the ship docked, a crowd of cheering Cratians holding up signs proclaiming their love and devotion to their new empress. "Welcome home, Empress Amara!" they called out to her. As she disembarked, children and mothers looked upon her with hope in their eyes. Hope that she wouldn't be the same as her father, an emperor who had been focused only on power, conquest, and unlimited fortune. Amara would be different, these women believed. Better, kinder, more benevolent and focused on unity and peace in a way male rulers in the past hadn't been. Amara smiled at them all, but found that the tight feeling in her chest wouldn't ease. All these people, they would all perish at the hands of the kindred if Lucia failed. Lucia couldn't fail. Amara had confidence in the sorceress's magic, in her prophecy, in the determination she'd seen in Lucia's eyes when she'd first entered the compound, searching for her brother and father. For a moment, just a moment before the king's entourage had departed for Aranus, Amara had wanted to ask Lucia if she might heal her broken leg with her earth magic as a favor. But she had held her tongue, doubting that the reply would be positive. "I earned this injury," she whispered to herself as she leaned against her cane. The pain had eased, but walking was awkward and slow. She shrugged off the assistance of the guards who surrounded her, preferring to hobble along without any help. She took in the sights of the jewel on the carriage ride to the Emerald Spear, the royal residence she'd lived in since birth. Sometimes she forgot how beautiful the jewel was. It hadn't received its name by accident. Everywhere she looked, her surroundings literally hummed with life, with lush green trees bearing flat waxy leaves, far taller and fuller than anything she'd seen in Mitica. The flowers, mostly shades of purple which had been the Emperor's favorite color, were each as big as a serving platter. The air was fresh and fragrant with the smell of the flowers and of the salty sea that surrounded the small island. Amara closed her eyes and tried to focus only on the feel of the humid air on her bare arms, on the intoxicating scents of the jewel, on the cheers from crowds they passed. When she opened her eyes again, the palace stretched up into the very clouds like a priceless shard of glittering emerald. It had been her father's design, built years before she was born. He'd never been happy with it, thought it not high enough, not sharp enough, not impressive enough. But Amara loved it. And now it belonged to her, and her alone. And for a moment, she pushed aside her doubts, her fears, her guilt, and allowed herself to bask in her victory. Truly the greatest victory by any woman in history. The future for all the people who had cheered upon her arrival would be as bright as the ancient scepter she would raise at her public ascension. It would be a grand ceremony, much like her father's had been many years ago, long before her birth, that would live forever through the paintings and sculptures commissioned to document it. And then all, whether they liked it or not, would have to worship and obey the first empress in mortal history. Wearing purple robes, her hair arranged into a thick, neat bun at the back of her head, Mila waited for her in the grand, shining entryway to the spear. The old woman reached her arms out toward her granddaughter. Guards lined the circumference of the palace's ground floor. Amara's cane made a clicking sound on the green metallic floors as she closed the distance between them. Then Amara allowed her grandmother to take her into a warm embrace.
"My beautiful Dosha has returned to me,"
Mila said. Amara's throat tightened and her eyes stung.
"I've missed you, my Dosha,"
she whispered.
"And I you."
Amara couldn't take her eyes off her grandmother. The old woman looked anything but old today. She was vibrant. Her skin glowed, her eyes sparkled. Even her steel-gray hair seemed shinier and fuller.
"You look wonderful, Madosha,"
Amara told her.
"Clearly, staving off a revolution does wonders for the skin."
Mila laughed lightly, touching her own smooth, tanned cheeks.
"That's hardly to account for this. My apothecary created a special elixir for me, one that has certainly contributed to my renewed strength. During your stay in Little Mitica, I knew I couldn't allow my age and ailments to slow me down."
The apothecary was a mysterious man who had worked secretly for the Cortes family for many years. Amara made note to meet him in person very soon. She knew he was also responsible for the magical potion that had brought her back to life as a mere baby, the same potion that had made Asher's resurrection possible. This was a man she needed to know, a man she needed to control.
"I have so much to tell you,"
Amara said.
"Perhaps not as much as you think. I have been kept fully apprised of all that has gone on in Little Mitica, despite the rather short and cryptic messages I have received from you. Come, let's speak in private, away from curious ears, shall we?"
Mildly surprised, Amara followed her grandmother through the long, narrow hallways of the spear to the east wing, out into the rock garden in Amara's private courtyard. She gazed around at her favorite place in the palace, a place that her father had hated since he thought it ugly and uninspired. But Amara had acquired each of the tens of thousands of rocks, shiny, ugly, beautiful, all sizes and colors, over her lifetime, and thought them each a treasure.
"I've missed this place," she said. "I'm sure you did."
A servant brought them a tray of wine and a selection of exotic fruits, unlike anything available in Mitica. Amara's mouth watered at the sight of them. Mila poured them both a goblet of wine, and Amara took a deep drink. Pelcian wine. The same wine she'd used to poison her family. She swallowed it down, although her stomach churned at the memory.
"Asher is still alive,"
Mila said, after she too drank from her goblet. Amara froze mid-sip, then took a moment to compose herself.
"He is. He acquired the resurrection potion from your apothecary. I am also told that after you captured him, he managed to escape."
Again Amara exhaled slowly, evenly, before she replied.
"He won't be a problem. Your ascension isn't for nearly a week. If your brother shows his face here, if he claims the right to the title of emperor..."
"He won't."
"How can you be sure of that?"
"I just am. My brother is preoccupied with other issues in Mitica.
The young man he's come to care for far too deeply for his own good. The one who is currently the vessel for the Fire Kindred."
Amara just stared at her now, stunned.
"Who told you all this?"
Mila raised her brows, taking a plump red grape from the top of the platter, inspecting it carefully before popping it in her mouth and chewing slowly.
Do you deny any of it?
Uneasiness spread through her. Her grandmother didn't trust her. If she did, she would have felt no need for a spy. A very well-informed spy, it would seem.
I don't deny it,
Amara said, pushing back against her uncertainty.
I've done what I felt I must. I tried to find a way to control the kindred. It was impossible, and now... Well, I've left quite a mess behind.
Amara's voice was shaking.
Kayan could destroy the world, Madosha. And it would be all my fault.
Neela shook her head, her expression serene.
I've learned in my lifetime to control only what is possible. When something is out of my hands, I let it be free. What is done is done. The problems in Mitika are Mitika's problems, not ours. Do you think there is a chance these elemental gods will succeed against the sorceress?
Amara's grip tightened on her goblet.
I don't know.
Is there anything you can do to be of assistance to her?
I could only make things worse, I think.
It's best that I'm here now. Then it is done. And what will be, will be.
Neela poured herself more wine.
You should know that King Gaius de Mora is dead.
What?
Amara fell speechless for a moment.
He's dead.
How?
An arrow to the heart. He was halted in the middle of a speech about how he meant to defeat you and take back his precious tiny kingdom.
Amara allowed the shock of this incredible news to wash over her. Gaius was dead. Her enemy. Her husband. The man who'd married her for the chance to align with her father. The man she'd briefly believed might be an asset to her reign until he betrayed her at the first opportunity. She knew she should be pleased by this news. Had she not feared Lucia's wrath, she would have had him executed herself. Still, it seemed so strange that a man as powerful and as ruthless as Gaius de Mora could be taken from the world by a mere arrow.
Unbelievable,
she whispered.
I chose the assassin well, Dosha,
Neela said. Amara glanced up from her goblet, shocked by her grandmother's words.
It was your doing?
Neela nodded, her gaze steady.
King Gaius presented a potential obstacle to your future. Now you are a widow, ready to marry anyone of your choosing.
Amara shook her head. Perhaps her grandmother expected gratitude rather than shock for taking this extreme step. Could she have made such a choice? Gaius was most definitely a problem, but one like everything else she'd left behind, that she'd decided to deal with after her ascension, when her power was absolute and unshakable.
Of course you were right to have made this choice, Amara finally said. However, I do wish you'd consulted me first.
The result would have been the same, only delayed. Some problems require immediate attention.
Amara limped a few paces away, her grip on her cane painfully tight.
I'm curious who it is in my compound that has been sending you so many detailed messages.
A small smile touched Neela's lips.
Someone who will be arriving soon with a very special gift I have acquired for you.
Intriguing. Care to share more?
Not just yet. But I believe this gift will be incredibly useful to us both for many years to come. I will say no more, since I want it to be a surprise.
Amara forced herself to relax. Despite the jarring news of Gaius's assassination, she knew she needed to give thanks for her grandmother's intelligence, strength, and foresight, rather than question it.
The jewel is beautiful and calm again,
Amara said after a peaceful silence fell between them. She had strolled around her garden, touching her favorite rocks, and remembering the very place she'd put the aquamarine orb when it had briefly been in her possession.
It is,
Neela agreed.
Most of the rebels were put to death immediately upon arrest, but we have their leader here in the palace awaiting